Welcome to session 334, titled Beyond Passive Aggression, Creating a Culture of Collaboration. You've heard the spiel before. Turn off your phones, be nice, and buy the coffee out front. All right, recent research has demonstrated that the Latter-day Saint community, especially among the Wasatch Front, has developed an unhealthy culture of passive aggression. What can be done about this? Rather than focusing on the dysfunction, this paper will present a variety of concrete steps, learnable skills, and case studies that show us ways to develop healthy collaborative norms in LDS culture. Our presenter will be Michael J. Stevens, Management Professor and Department Chair at Weber State University, where he teaches and conducts research in the areas of organizational behavior and leadership. He also serves on the Sunstone Board of Directors. And not in your program, we will be having a response by Wendy Fox Kirk, Assistant Professor of Management at Weber State University, who has a research interest in leadership. She has been teaching management and leadership skills focused on building collaborative cultures. She is an advocate of post-heroic forms of leadership, because now more global forms of organizing require the empowerment of all members in the organization to encourage them to participate in leadership processes. She will be bringing a perspective as an experienced coach and leader in teaching people collaboration skills.
Passive-aggressive responses, good heavens. Who would have thought, right? Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. As the introduction mentioned, I'm a professor of organizational psychology, but in a business school we call it organizational behavior, and get paid more because we do. But in any case, if any of you are involved with organizations misbehaving, give me a call and we'll try and sort them out. I'm just going to give a two-minute background on the original paper that I wrote about this. Appeared in the Sunstone magazine in March 2013. The background is that for a variety of circumstances beyond my control, I ended up back here on the Wasatch Front 7 years ago and began teaching my usual rotation of classes. One of the common themes that I always end up teaching is on the topic of conflict management, conflict resolution, and so on. So for years, I have been using this simple little model. It's a two-dimensional model. You'll see along the vertical here, it talks about assertiveness, and along the horizontal, regard for the other person. This is a real simple model. It's been around for decades in the area of conflict management. And I use this as a way of introducing conflict management in most of the classes that I teach. I also have a simple little 12-minute survey questionnaire that people can answer. I usually give students right there in class. They'll go through, answer about 50 questions, and they can score it on the spot, and it will identify where in these five different areas of the model their conflict handling behavior falls out. So if you take someone who is high on assertiveness, especially with regard for their own interests, that would be competition. If you take someone who's low on both their assertiveness and their regard for the other person, you have avoidance down here in the bottom left. Over here where you have high regard for the other person, care little about your own interests, that would be accommodation. Right in the middle, compromise is the one that kind of splits the different on all of them. This is the lukewarm and get spewed out kind of a, no, not really. When it comes to organizational life, compromise is certainly a lot better than all-out warfare, but at the end of the day, it usually ends up satisficing the decisions that you make rather than coming up with an ideal scenario. And then up in the top right-hand corner, noticeably in the color purple for dinosaurs and Barney and all that sort of stuff, you have what people believe is the fantasy of collaboration. This is the win-win approach. So over the 20 years or so that I've been teaching, before I got here to the Wasatch Front, mainly in the Midwest and the border region in Texas, I would give students the questionnaire, and they could score themselves in these different areas on numbers that range from 0 to 12. And so over the years before I got here, I kind of had a sense for how people scored. First semester at Weber State University, I handed out the exercise. We're covering the chapter on conflict resolution. And lo and behold, I get numbers like this. For Weber, for my students at Weber State, the average on avoidance was 9.1 if they had been born and raised here along the Wasatch Front on a score of 0 to 12, whereas the national, I call it national comparison, the Midwest and Texas regions, avoidance was the lowest of the five. It occurred very, very rarely. And when it did occur, it was almost always my women students in the business school who had the high avoidance scores. My first semester at Weber State, I had them do the exercise. They turn in like a little self-assessment essay where they talk about their approach and they turn it in. So I've just archived these homework assignments over the years, which is how I had that data. But the interesting thing here along the Wasatch Front, I found that men were just as likely to score off the charts on passive aggression as women. And that the first semester it happened, I just shrugged it off as, you know, some statistical anomaly and, you know, kind of went on my way. But by the third semester, it was clear this was a pattern, which is when I started to dig down and find more information that it was connected to having been born and raised in Utah and your LDS connection. So that started me thinking in terms of what might be behind the passive aggression. Identified three possible explanations. They're certainly not the only three, but they do make sense. As a people, we tend to confuse all conflict with contention, and we know that if you have the spirit of contention, you're in league with Beelzebub, right? So if all disagreement, even polite, respectful, saying, well, I have a different opinion, means you're being contentious, then it really leaves you no other way of engaging people when you do disagree. Second is that we clearly have a culture of obedience and submission, and if you don't believe me, I invite you to just bow your head and say yes. Third is we have what I call a high power culture. Which is another way of saying our culture is very deeply embedded in what we call deference to leaders. So we can come back and say more about that later, but if you're interested, I walked through some of the arguments and reasoning in the March 13 article. What I want to do today, though, is try to move beyond this. Try to look at what happens when you try to move up here rather than wallowing the fact that we're deeply enmeshed in this passive-aggressive culture. In other words, the best way to leave and walk away and free yourself of passive-aggression tendencies is to instead move somewhere healthier. And if you move towards collaboration, your passive-aggression will, by definition, no longer be part of the way you operate, the way you think, the way you engage, and so on. So over the years, in addition to teaching classes about conflict management, I've also been teaching a people skills class that focuses on learnable, trainable, practicable kinds of skills and competencies that can get people towards collaboration. As I've been doing this work for the last 20 years, I've noticed a number of barriers that keep people from changing from whatever quadrant they're in, whether it's competition, whether it's accommodation, whether it's too much compromise rather than seeking win-win collaborative solutions. I have over the years noticed some very significant barriers to growth and change towards healthy collaboration. First of these is obviously what I would call a cognitive barrier. In other words, this is the barrier of knowing. If you don't understand what the options are, it's very difficult to move to healthy ground. So if you believe that your only options are competition or accommodation, which do you choose? That's like asking the question, do you prefer death by hanging or death by firing squad? Which would you pick? Death by hanging or death by firing squad? Anybody? Okay, suicide. Okay, a little thinking outside the box. But of those two, which would you pick? Firing squad? No, that's the wrong answer. Try again. Death by hanging or death by firing squad? No, that's the wrong answer. Try again. What? Neither. Very good. You don't have to pick one of the constraining options. But if your mental model says that I either got to be in, you know, a competitive a-hole who just like bulldozes whatever I need to get out of my way so that I get what I want, or avoid or accommodate, on the other hand, that really makes collaboration a possibility that will never get realized. You cannot achieve what you cannot conceive. Now, as soon as I introduce the model with collaboration up here in the top right-hand corner, what happens is most of the managers, leaders that I work with look at that and they go, oh, okay, I get what you mean, collaboration. Yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I've always been trying to do. Problem with that is then you start to talk to the people who work with them or who work for them or who spend time around them, they will give you a different answer. What happens is we may think that we are more collaborative because we intend to be more collaborative than we really are. So this is a different kind of cognitive barrier. It's one that is what I call a self-awareness bias. You have a blind spot. You think you're collaborative when in fact you really are not. You're either manipulative, you're trying to get what you want through passive-aggressive means, or you're overbearing in terms of control, but it comes from a nice heart, so you're a benevolent autocrat, right? I'm sorry, you're just benevolent, they like to say. And so, and I understand why this happens. This is what psychologists refer to as the fundamental attribution bias, which is I tend to give myself the benefit of the doubt when I make mistakes, but I also tend to take the credit when I'm successful. And we also tend to reverse that for other people. When you misbehave, you're just a jerk. When you're successful, well, you just got lucky. And this is a very, very fundamental aspect of there's been research in psychology called the fundamental attribution bias. There's also another second aspect of this self-awareness bias, which is that we're more inclined to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. That if you didn't mean to be autocratic, you didn't mean to be overbearing, you didn't mean to be controlling, you didn't mean to be passive-aggressive or contemptuous or demeaning. Just you were in a hurry, you had a lot on your plate, you had too much going on, and so your behavior doesn't manifest the intention that you had all along. Problem is, our intentions reside in our psyche and in our hearts. What people see is our behavior. And then when they see that behavior, they kick in with their fundamental attribution bias, and they attribute to us all sorts of nefarious character flaws and so on. But it's important to understand each of these barriers, because I'm going to come back and hit each one in succession and talk about possible solutions. So the second of the four barriers is what I call a skill set barrier. This is just a function of behaviors that you actually can learn, that you can practice, that you can engage to move from avoidance or accommodation or competition to healthy collaboration. Third is what I call affective barriers, or barriers of emotional feelings and even emotional intelligence. Fourth has to do with core values and beliefs. In other words, your character. What kind of a fundamental human being are you in terms of your desires, preferences, goals, interests, and agenda in life? What do you aspire to have and to hold and to achieve? So these four barriers, knowing, doing, feeling, being, then provide an overview, if you will, of the kinds of things you need to tackle in order to move to that upper right-hand corner of collaboration in your relationships with other people. So improving your cognitive models is pretty straightforward. It's a matter of simply introducing the model. It's not a particularly difficult conceptual model. So the cognitive barrier is rather straightforward. There's the assertiveness, concern for self on the vertical, and on the horizontal is the low versus high regard for others. That's pretty straightforward. The biggest challenge is what happens when we try to deal with our self-awareness biases, and that actually is something that can be addressed more by skill sets. So the kind of skill sets that would be important to practice and master in order to develop the behaviors and competencies that you need to move beyond the barriers that you're confronting would be these learnable, trainable sorts of things. So the first one, the sizing up skills, is a skill that involves identifying conflict behaviors more objectively. That is, being able to take an instance of behavior that's being presented either by you or by others and identify it as in fact competitive and not collaborative, or in fact avoidance and not collaborative, or in fact accommodating, and so on. So being able to accurately in the moment size up behavior is a skill that you can learn that will help strip us of our self-awareness biases. Now, the challenge is it's not an easy skill to develop or practice, and it does usually involve work with and help from trained facilitators or coaches, like Wendy, for example. It's not natural or intuitive for most people. The difference that I would describe between the getting past your cognitive barriers and your skill set barriers is the difference between learning about baseball versus learning how to play baseball. Those are two very fundamentally different things. You could take a class in the physics of why a curveball curves. Anybody in here play baseball and ever see a curveball coming at you? Anybody here know how to throw a curveball? Okay, one hand. Well, for the rest of you, see, this is a skill set issue. You could actually take a class from the physics department here on campus, and you learn all about the aerodynamic laws that govern a curveball and makes a curveball curve. It has to do with rotation and leading drag and things of that nature. You could even have a physicist, you know, write the equation out on the whiteboard, and you go home and memorize it and repeat it back on exams and get an A for that class. And if somebody came up to you and said, do you know what a curveball is? Oh, yes, of course. Oh, here's a ball. Show me how to throw one. Well, here's the equation, and you write it like this. Knowing isn't the same as being able to do, but knowing helps an awful lot. So if you know, for example, why a curveball curves and the physics behind it, you can actually enhance your ability to master the skill that you need to rotate and release the ball this way as opposed to that way, and there are reasons behind it. So that's what a lot of these skills require of us. It's the difference between learning how to actually play baseball rather than learning about it. So collaborative skills require the interpersonal equivalent analogy of giving someone a baseball and a bat and a glove and sending them out on a baseball field and letting them have at it for a while. Ideally not just on their own free-ranging baseball practice, but with a trained facilitator or coach or guide. Organizing skills is one that refers to not at the organization level, but is a skill that has to do with how you organize your interactions with other people. For example, very simple is the skill set of getting the other person's views before you share your own. Now, in terms of complicated skill sets, that's actually a lot easier to master than throwing a curveball. But Many of us fail to do it, often because of some emotional things that get in the way we'll come back to in just a minute. Motivating skills has to do with being able to sort out and determine what naturally resonates with the other person that you're working with, because in most cases with collaboration, you are working with other people. And co-labor is the root of the word collaboration. You're working with someone. So as you work with other people, you cannot compel or coerce, because then what happens is people exercise coercion and unrighteous dominion. Well, we're persecuting the saints and fighting against God. That's what section 121 tells us, right? So working with someone requires that you work hard to understand who they are, where they come from, what their personal goals, ambitions, interests are in life, and then honoring and respecting their integrity to approach things from whatever frame of reference and core values resonate with them. Four skill sets, communicating. But by communicating, I mean more specifically probing and listening. Where with communication skills, essentially 90% of the conversation should be you listening and the other person talking if you do it well. Probing and listening, the art of asking questions, though, is a lot more nuanced than it might sound on the surface, because it has to come from a heart of genuine inquiry and empathic questioning rather than questioning with an agenda, questioning to try to get the other person to say what you want to say. That's not the kind of probing and questioning and communicating you need for collaboration. That's the kind of questioning and probing you would use to get compulsion and submission from others. And then last of all, working with people so that they can adjust and adapt from wherever they happen to be. Because we're not all created equal. Despite what the preamble to the Constitution says, we do come at life and the world from decidedly different perspectives and orientations. So taking that into account when you work with people is critical to pulling all this stuff off. So this is the second of the four barriers to change, and the one having to do with barriers of doing. Skill sets are actually things you can develop and practice. You work on them with people who are trained facilitators. The third one is the set of issues that I describe as barriers due to emotion or affective. That's what we mean by affective. It's a word psychologists use, kind of an umbrella term to describe our human emotions and our human psyche. And as you look at that, you'll see that some of the things that pop out under this particular heading are barriers that have to do with limited self-awareness, which I mentioned before. Also kind of a cognitive barrier, but I think it fits much more neatly here as an affective or an emotional intelligence barrier. The self-regulation part, though, is where my experience, most of the challenge for most of us comes most of the time. So, for example, I suggested on the previous slide, the second bullet point here, the organizing skills, that is getting the views of others before giving yours, is not a particularly complicated skill to master, but the self-regulation thing really gets in the way and keeps us from deploying that skill set effectively. What do I mean by that? Well, if you go into a conversation or trying to resolve a conflict or deal with a disagreement with somebody else, and you go into that with a particular point of view and the other person disagrees, what that skill set requires of getting the other person's views first is you've got to ask questions from this moron on the other side of the table that just starts talking, and you get so frustrated that you just want to shut them down, and you go, you know, if you would just like listen for a minute to me and I would clarify and clear up all this confusion that you have, so just be quiet and let me set you straight kind of an attitude. That's coming out of our emotions. It's coming out of a limited capacity for patience, for resilience, and for the self-regulation that we need to find the empathy to engage other people. So empathy is fairly straightforward as a word, but it's very complicated in terms of our approach. There are actually things you can do to develop empathy. And if we have some time during a Q&A, we might come back to that. There's some very interesting resources, but if you go to the interwebs and Google something like developing empathy or empathy skills, there are all kinds of exercises, activities, books, and things like that where you can actually develop it the way you would develop other kinds of skills. And then social skills broadly to deploy our emotional intelligence in ways that work through these barriers. Now, the fourth one, I would argue, is the deepest and most intractable of these four barriers, but it's also the most foundational. And I've got seven different bullets on this one. The first core value or character or dispositional trait, if you will, that is at the heart of character that makes collaboration possible is what I refer to as a commitment to servant leadership. Now, this is a difficult one for lots of my business and management students to comprehend. And the term servant leadership was actually coined by an executive at AT&T back in the 1960s. But the interesting thing is most of my undergraduate students getting their business degrees and most of the students in the MBA program are not interested in getting their degrees so that they can be the servant in the least of all. But, you know, that's not what servant leadership means. Specifically, there's an example in the book of Mark in chapter 10. Where this is early on, Jesus is just kind of getting his ministry on track. And starting in verse 35, Mark tells us that two of his disciples, James and John, come to him, and they said, in effect, you know, Jesus, we got an idea that you're the real deal, and we're okay with that. We want to be your disciples, but, you know, in all modesty, if we could, if you don't mind, we'd kind of like to be on your left hand and your right hand. What do you say to that? Now, in our language, you know, in modern 21st century America, that's not a particularly common saying, being on the right hand and on the left hand. But in the ancient world, when somebody was in charge and had authority and kind of at the top of the pyramid, if you couldn't be that person, the next best thing was to be what? The person who controlled access. That's what it means to be on their right hand and their left hand. So if you can't be president of the United States, next best thing is to be chief of staff who controls the president's calendar and agenda and decides who doesn't get into the White House, into the Oval Office, right? So James and John come to Jesus and they say, you know, in all modesty, in fact, it's such an embarrassing question that when Matthew tells the story, he changes it and says, well, it was their mom who came and asked for them. Because Jewish mothers could ask anything for their sons. But in any event, Jesus says, okay, just a minute. Let's back up. He says, Jesus responds to him. He says, first of all, you don't know what you're asking. And besides, I have a question for you. Are you willing to drink of the cup that I drink from and to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? And their response, oh, yeah, yeah, no, we're on board, whatever, that's fine, we're cool with it. He says, no, you don't understand. He says, you've heard it said that you know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship over everybody else. And their great ones exercise authority over everyone. In other words, they've got this model of leadership that's imbued with this rank has its privilege kind of an identity. That the farther up the organizational chart you move, the farther up the food chain you're going. And the more you then can lord and rule it over others. But of course, when you're a Latter-day Saint, you have to do it with compassion and integrity, but it's still clear who's in charge, right? Okay. So Jesus is working all this, and he says, you know, look at the Gentiles. They have leaders who are in charge, but they lord it over everybody. And he says, what you all need to understand is that that's not the way it's going to be among you who want to be disciples in the kingdom of God. Whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister, and whosoever of you will be chiefest shall be servant of all. For even the Son of Man, this is referring to himself, says, even the Son of Man, I didn't come to have people suck up to me. I didn't come to be at the top of the food chain. I came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give my life as a ransom for many. So if you want to be disciples and get with the program that I'm trying to put forward, you need to understand that leadership, first and foremost, means that you eat last. You got to make sure that everybody in the community is taken care of. This is the heart of servant leadership. Now, at the same time, though, servant leadership is not obsequious, okay? Servant leadership doesn't mean that you are humble in a way where you abdicate. That's not servant leadership. Servant leadership says whatever resources, whatever skills, whatever talents, whatever capacity you have at your disposal, you use them to build up those you lead and to bless the flock and to feed the sheep. That's what you do as a leader. You put yourself at the end of the line when it comes to mealtime, because that's what you do if you're the servant. But it's not. There's no weakness at all in this kind of leadership. It's humility, but without obsequiousness. And this is another point of confusion, because I've often heard people justify their passive aggression as humility in the similitude of I'm just turning the other cheek. Now, that can be a source of confusion, because many of us read, you know, where Jesus talks about turning the other cheek in his Sermon on the Mount, and we think, okay, well, you know, I have to be humble and I have to just take the abuse and contempt that people heap upon me. That's not what Jesus is saying when he teaches us that as disciples we have to turn the other cheek. This is a very specific saying within his culture at that time and in his day. Middle Eastern culture that day, in fact, most cultures on earth today live by what anthropologists call honor-shame societies. Here in the United States, we tend to live by what would be referred to as a goal achievement culture, and the best way to get even or to get back at somebody is to win. Whereas in honor-shame societies, such as the one Jesus lived in the Middle East, the best way to achieve status in your culture is to not be dishonored, to not let anyone shame you. And so within this context, Jesus then says, if someone comes up to you and slaps you on the cheek, everybody knew exactly what he meant. If someone comes up and slaps me on the cheek, it's not going to hurt, probably not even going to knock me down, but it's going to convey insult. And then in the rules of an honor-shame society, in order for me to maintain my honor, I have to slap him back. And now I've slapped him back, and what he's got to do is he's got to slap me back, or he's dishonored, and now all of a sudden my brothers get involved, and his cousins get involved, and our tribes get involved, and there you have the Middle East. So when Jesus says, if someone comes up to you and slaps you on the cheek, just stop it right there. And the other person is not going to have a clue what to do next, because it's like this makes absolutely no sense to them. What he's saying is not if someone slaps you on the cheek. He's not saying fall on the ground, ball up in a fetal position, let him really go to town on you. He's saying don't respond in kind. Figure out a better way. Don't, as we say, quote, take the bait, unquote, and perpetuate cycles of competition, violence, contempt, hostility, and dismissiveness. So responding with strength and humility. How many of you were at Don Crossan's talk Wednesday night, right? He talked about the power and the strength of nonviolent resolve in response to violence and conflict. There's nothing weak at all about it, but it's very humble in a paradoxical sort of a way. The other thing you need in order to pull off healthy collaboration is what I what some authors refer to as an abundance heart. How many of you have heard this term before? An abundance heart versus a scarcity heart. Okay? If you have a scarcity heart, essentially you're looking at the world through lens of competition where I got to get mine, and that doesn't necessarily make me a bad person, but there's only so much to go around, and good luck to you. An abundance heart, though, looks at things and says, if I'm in a position of authority or power, or I have leadership responsibilities, you know what? I can empower you as well to join me in this leadership mission, and that in that, because of that, leadership actually grows. There's more of an abundance. You need to have a heart of compassion, genuine regard and respect for the other person. Trusting. A trusting nature where you're willing to give people the benefit of the doubt from the gate as opposed to suspicion. And a heart of forgiveness and forbearance in the face of inconsistencies or when people live up to their fullest potential, so that rather than focusing on blame and fixing accountability, it's more a question of how do we grow and move on. And then last of all, unwavering integrity and resolve. Now, what would happen if we had all of these things going for us? We would have what Moses talks about in Numbers 11, where he refers to the situation where he's preaching in the tabernacle. He gets everybody connected with the Spirit. He leaves, and the people who were there continued prophesying. A couple of them really got into it, and one fellow gets Joshua, and they go to Moses and say, Moses, you got to come back. Everybody back to the tabernacle. They're all like prophesying and full of the Spirit, and this is improper. You're the prophet. You need to do this. And Moses' response was, would that all of God's people were prophets. Now, what would it look like if we had a world full of strong, empowered, collaborative people? It probably looks very different from the traditional model that you would see in an orchestra where you have a conductor in charge. I don't know how many of you ever heard the example where the church is sometimes referred to as a symphony orchestra, and you and I as rank and file members, we're the ones, the musicians in the orchestra, and we just have to follow our leaders who are inspired and capable, and they know better and they know everything. A lot of that argument, I think, is encapsulated in the short little interview clip from a fellow named Zubin Mehta, one of the world's great conductors.
There's something very mystical about this whole conducting profession, if you can call it. When you look at it per se, it's very simple. You can really learn it in a half an hour. But then you ask, why are there so few really great conductors, if it's that easy? Conducting is communication. You communicate with one musician, you communicate with a group in the orchestra, and you communicate with the orchestra as a whole. What you communicate to them, or to him or her, has to convince him or her or the group or the orchestra of what your intentions are. Your intentions come out of hopefully a deep knowledge of the score and therefore of the style. Now, an orchestra is made out of 110 minds, interpreters. Somebody has to decide from the upbeat, which is the tempo, the speed of the music, then whether the different polyphonic voices blend together. He has to balance it. He has to check the internal intonation. He has to see whether the bowings played by the string musicians are logical to his interpretation of that particular phrase. And he has to have the construction of the piece very clear in his mind, so that he is the only one who always has the light at the end of the tunnel, the light at the end of the slow movement of the eroica, the light at the end of a certain passage in Parsifal. The individual musician is too busy making music, pouring his heart out, to concentrate on that light. It is the conductor who guides the general movement so that the construction at the end of the piece is logical. That is the mixture of all these qualities and the knowledge of it which makes this mystical profession called conducting such a unique phenomenon of especially the 20th century.
And that makes sense, right? I mean, someone's got to be in charge. You got all those musicians around. If someone's not up in front, someone's not in charge, you have chaos. And rather than harmony, you're going to have a cacophony. So someone's got to be in charge. They don't necessarily have to be a malevolent dictator. They could be. And as we know, Section 121 tells us, as soon as you give somebody, even with a little authority, give them the baton, what happens? That's right. The exercise of unrighteous dominion. This is the norm, it says. This is what happens when to almost all men and women. So what happens if you had an orchestra that actually didn't have a conductor? Well, let me introduce you to the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, a Grammy Award-winning orchestra that, in fact, has no conductor.
Set him in the window right away, please. Can we really just hit him and get out of the way? It's right. It's immediate. It's not, you know, you don't hold
the shirt.
Our approach is that we're dealing with the individual musician. Every musician is a source of inspiration. They'd call us the headless wonder, or they would say, this orchestra has 26 conductors.
A setting in which all the musicians feel that they can have a voice and that their opinions are respected, and not only respected but actually put into play. I don't want to say that the main principle of orchestra is to play without a conductor. That's very obvious. The reasons for not playing with a conductor are for every musician to feel the personal responsibility.
And I'd like to try this even more.
And then in the fiddles, the solo, when you have the beat-up, ba-ba-ba-ba, the second note sounds equal to the first note. And it might be nice to
they might
really
be accents, I don't know.
Huh?
Yeah, they might just be accents, I don't know.
Also, the second note answer. Conversely, can we, I know it's printed in the part, we maybe ignore after five, one, two, three, four, five, six, seventh bar, take out that fourth just so we're still in a crescendo.
Yeah.
Okay, but we don't need to do it right now.
No.
Do you know what's still not clear is the seventh bar in the winds? Are you taking a little time?
It's a very difficult position to be in, to be a concert master. You have several different roles. One is to be chief of the process. The other is that at the same time you're putting forth a vision. You know that you need to leave some room for other people to participate in the process.
Can you try up bow so it keeps us kind of on the edge?
We don't hate conductors. When you have a conductor, people abdicate of a huge portion of the responsibility to him. If he says play louder, they play louder. If he says play softer, they play softer. Or maybe they don't, you know, but whatever.
Right. Well, we're all collectively doing the job of a music director. Yeah, we're all listening to everything as a whole.
You know, when you have an orchestra with a conductor, it's always leashed. Almost always. Unless the conductor's great or an idiot. In Orpheus, the energy that's there doesn't get leashed. It's there and then it starts to go.
Consider just letting us try at the tip for a while.
But if you're doing it at the tip, by tip you mean on the string? You mean really
just
on?
just in this place.
In the second key.
Yeah, but it's only for. I mean, I think it still sounds light and nice, and it makes it work, you know.
And then. Okay, then I think we should do the coda thing.
Fine. Then
and then what? But why?
Why not?
Why not? Okay, I don't know.
We have developed our own rehearsal technique, a chamber music style, knowing when to accept in a democratic sort of way when your idea is just not going to fly.
It requires a degree of trust. Then the group begins to function ideally.
That's going to be your thing today. I see
it
that.
It is. It really was.
It's different. Anyway.
Is that hard to do that multi string and to use a lot of big bow in the first note?
We can try like that. I don't see, I mean, you see, where we differ is I don't think that it has to match.
Yeah. Especially this spot doesn't have to match because it's such a mysterious.
Yeah.
So that's an example of a typical rehearsal for the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I actually use this as a case study in my graduate business class. I ask students to evaluate this collaborative leadership model as a potential for organizing and running their own businesses. What percentage of my students would you guess resoundingly reject this as a possible model, this Orpheus model? 100%, close to 80%. They want absolutely nothing to do with it. They're being a passive aggressive here in Utah, right? No, actually, probably 20% find it very compelling, very, very inspiring, and would love to have it. But the challenge is that there's this urge that there's just too much chaos, too much cacophony. But I suggest to you that this is what a Zion people looks like. And that when you are able to achieve collaboration, you have a Zion community where people are of one heart, one mind, one soul, where individual agency finds a balanced harmony with social well-being. And that the model of the omnipotent conductor in front is rife with so many dysfunctional consequences that it's amazing we're still here as a people. But I am going to turn the time over to Wendy here to give us the summary.
Okay, thank you, Michael. So I thought it would be useful to understand why we engage in passive aggression. Okay, why do we do it if it results in all these things that Michael talks about, that it's not beneficial in the long term? And actually, passive aggression as an approach is engaged in by certain groups more often than others. So as Michael's identified, LDS, UTAN communities engage in passive aggression. When we look at the general public and outside Utah, it's women who engage in passive aggression. Very, very common. Not all women, obviously, but the majority of women engage in passive aggression to manage conflict. And there's a very good reason for this, because as women, we're socialized to be nice. Okay, from a very early age, we're socialized to be compliant, to be nice, to think of others. Think of Michael's kind of matrix. We've got concern for self on the one side, concern for others on the other side. And so we've, as women, we have to at least look like we're nice, okay? Might not be that nice underneath. So we're always managing the way people observe us, the way people see us, okay? And this huge discourse is driving, in terms of the greater population, it's femininity. You know, femininity is care for others, concern for others, being good, being kind. And so when we transpose that into the LDS community, one of the strongest messages is to be more like Jesus, okay? To develop righteousness, to be good and kind to others. And in the LDS community, I heard someone use a great phrase the other day, Julie, can't remember her surname, who said, in the LDS community, we engage in hyper-literalism, which I love that phrase. And what I can see has happened is for males and females in LDS Utah, because LDS UK is slightly different, and LDS Kiwi as well, apparently. What has happened is that being Christ-like and developing Christ-like features and attitudes and values has become being nice, okay? And Jesus actually wasn't always nice, if we actually look at what he did. But somehow that's happened. Further, we've got in the LDS religion a set of nice proxies, you know, that act as righteousness. This is what righteousness is. So it's keeping the word of wisdom, paying your tithe. You know, these lovely tick boxes, going to church. And so this, the element of the passive-aggressive approach or response to managing this being nice, being good out here, whilst this turmoil of desires for myself and difficult emotions popping up, the way that's managed is to engage in acts which appear to satisfy those external needs. Okay? So then you're left with this bubbling underneath. So in LDS community, if I do all of these things, I'm righteous, right? I'm like Jesus. That's all I have to do, isn't it? Word of wisdom. And there you go. Hey, we've got Zion. So, but no, it doesn't work like that. And often what you see actually is because emotions are not dealt with in an authentic way or owned, what you actually see is even more small-mindedness, mean-spiritedness. And so this is the classic passive-aggressive approach to feeling a sense of, Carl Rogers talks about creating this ideal self, but feeling like I can't really do it. It's unachievable, and it doesn't fit with this, you know, impoverished, angry, bitter person here inside. And so Carl Rogers says there's the ideal self and there's the real self. And the greater the incongruence, the difference between those two things, the greater your mental instability, ultimately. Okay, but the most important point is that passive aggression as a strategy in the short term means that I can focus on my concern for self whilst looking like I'm concerning for others. Okay, so it actually does fit the bill, as it were, in the short term. So the benefits of passive aggression are that I actually can express my anger and contempt without having the responsibility for expressing my anger and contempt. So I'm just going to give you, and I can control other people. did you want to ask a question? Is that why you were?
Well, I was thinking that one of the benefits of passive aggression is survival.
And survival, absolutely.
We live in I didn't hear anything said about social pressure as one of the reasons why people don't change. Changing in the way was described from being passive aggressive to a collaborative model will get you killed, literally, depending on the social situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a fear that Utah Mormons as a whole would not fare very well if they were in Milgram's electroshock
tank. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You're laughing, and that's great, but I'm not.
No, no. So you're right, and the benefits of passive aggression does come from fear. It does come from managing fear and shame. And one of the ways that we're going to break that is what we're asking people to do. I love Michael's call for unwavering integrity and resolve. That's easy, yeah, and we can all do that, you know. So it's actually a quite rational response to being asked to do something that we feel we cannot stand up to, and I take your point of the social pressure and the conformity and the fear and shame and face saving. So I'm just going to give you an example of control, because that's important as well, is you maintain control over others to some extent. It can give you an illusion of control, but it can give you real control. So I'll give you an example. I was at a conference in California, and I came back to Salt Lake City Airport. And my son said, "We'll pick you up." My son and daughter, "We'll pick you up." And my daughter-in-law gets on the phone, and, "Are you there?" "Yeah, I'm here." She's like, "Choose your restaurant, any restaurant. We're taking you out to dinner. Just choose your restaurant." So I'm like, "Oh, right, great." I'm down in Salt Lake because I live way up north. So there's loads of interesting restaurants. And I think I decided Middle Eastern. Way Middle Eastern. And so she said, "Okay, yes, any restaurant." "Well, Middle Eastern." "Okay." "Okay, that's fine. If you want Middle Eastern, yeah, sure." So my son's then, "Did you not want Middle Eastern?" She'll remain nameless. No, "That's perfectly okay. That's okay. I mean, it makes me feel sick when I've had it before, but no, that's okay. If Wendy's been on the conference and she's had a long journey." So I'm kind of like, "Oh my gosh, I can't bear this." So I'm like, "Well, where would you like to go?" "No, we're going where you want to go." And we went through this torturous, and we went where she wanted to go. Okay, because I just can't bear it. So another, and that's a funny situation, but in terms of marriages and things, what can happen sometimes if someone isn't being honest and open about their desires, then that's very frustrating. That was the feeling that I was kind of frustrated. I mean, just tell me, why did you put that offer on the table when it wasn't genuine? Because I wouldn't have cared if she said, "Let's go to my favorite restaurant." I'd have gone, "Okay, you know." So there's lots of benefits to being passive-aggressive. However, in terms of long-term, there are major disadvantages. So Michael talked about these cognitive biases that we have, and one that we have is what's known as a projection of values, self-values onto others. So we assume the values that we have are what other people hold. So if I'm behaving passive-aggressively, what I'm actually doing is I'm pretending to be nice, but I'm actually engaged in an internal dialogue of, well, what about my needs? And why is it always me? And, oh, I can't bear her, and she does this, and she... So that's all going on inside me, and I'm assuming that other people are engaged in that activity as well. So there's a major breakdown of trust. Michael highlighted the importance of trust. There's a major breakdown of trust. And what happens longer term is that people engage in these scripts, these why me scripts. They engage in a delusion of self and lack of self-awareness, and they begin to assume that others are out to get them. So what we end up with is paranoia, and as Carl Rogers says, this extreme incongruence between self, ideal self, and real self, leads to anxiety and depression. So, how do we fix it? So as Michael said, we have to engage in, okay, I'll be quick. We have to engage in the development of new skills. And these are communication skills by and large, okay? Although sizing up as well is hugely important, being aware of and calibrating whether you're actually in one of those passive-aggressive conflicts or interactions. So I'm just going to go through one technique that's useful, the broken record technique. But what you'll recognise is, especially in close relationships, it's going to unsettle the whole of the relationship, and that's another reason why we don't engage in it. It's another reason why we just go along with the, you know, if I really challenge my daughter-in-law, then I'm going to damage that relationship, and then my son, it's a big mess. So the broken record helps to create a sense of self-awareness in the person engaging in passive aggression. So the passive aggression aggressive person or person engaging in that behavior may begin with, you need to watch what you're eating, you're getting fat. So instead of just engaging in the way that I did with my daughter-in-law and trying to kowtow and give them that reward, what has to happen is they have to not get a reward for being passive aggressive. So what I do is say, and you have to go first, and this is the difficulty, because you have to be vulnerable and trusting. I feel hurt when you call me fat. That's how you respond. That's not a normal response. It will feel awkward and cumbersome. So she might come back or he might come back with, I'm just saying because I'm really concerned about you. You know, I don't want you to put on weight. What about your health? So you don't respond normally. You go, I know you're concerned, but it still hurts when you call me fat. Now you're just being too sensitive, is the response you get. So broken record, that may be right, but it still hurts when you call me fat. Oh, just get over yourself. And at this point, when it's getting, now it's the hostility is becoming more clear, then now you have to say, I've told you a number of times, it hurts when you say I'm fat and you're still doing it, so I can only assume you're trying to hurt. Silence. Okay? I know, it's tough. practicing those communication skills are awkward. When you first learn to drive a car, it's awkward, especially stick shift in the UK. So, you know, I've got to look at the road. What? Everything at the same time. But the more you do it, eventually ends up being an unconscious process. So I just want to end there because I've run out of time. And if you wanted to ask more about communication skills and techniques to cope with difficult behaviours in others, I'd be happy to talk to people. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to our presenters.